This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
There's the well-known Gemara that deals with the question of the short passage of Vayehi b'msoya ha'aron, which is inserted in the parasha and is enclosed by two upside down nuns, one before the passage and one at the end of the passage. And the Gemara says in Shabbos Daf Kuf Tes Zayin, Tanya Rav Shimon Gamliel Omer, Rav Shimon Gamliel says, Asido parasha zu she'te'aker mikan v'tichosev b'mekoimo. This parasha, this little passage, is out of context, and it will one day be removed from here and placed in its correct position. V'loma kosvo chan, and why then was it placed here interimly? Kedei lahafzik ben puronus rishoino lepuronus shniyah. In order to separate between the negativeness, the punishment, the wrongdoing in the first place and in the second place. And it's difficult to see really what Puronus the Gemara is talking about. It is true that immediately after this passage we come onto the section where the people start complaining, they're unhappy with the food arrangements. But before that, there doesn't seem to be a passage of Puronus at all. And the Gemara continues. Puronus shniya maihi. What is the second Puronus? What is the second wrongdoing? Vayehi ha'om kemisoyinim. That's the parasha that talks about the people begin to complain, to grumble. Puronus rishoino. What then is the first Puronus? And the Gemara just quotes one pasuk and says, "Vayisu mehar Hashem." They traveled away from the mountain of Hashem, which is the pasuk immediately, two psukim immediately preceding this passage of Vayehi ben Soharin, where it says, "Vayisu mehar Hashem," and they traveled from the mountain of Hashem, derech shloishes yomim, on a route of 3 days. Va'arein bris Hashem nosea lifnehem derech shloishes yomim losu lohem menucho. And the Aroin of the covenant of Hashem traveled before them for the 3 days to find them a resting place. Va'anan Hashem aleihem yoimom, and the cloud of Hashem was upon them during the day. V'noso min ha'machaneh, as they traveled from the camp. That's all it says. So what does Vayisu mehar Hashem mean? What's the terrible thing? Omer Rabbi Chama ber Chanina, shesoru me'acharei Hashem. Vayisu mehar Hashem is not merely telling us the geographical movement of location, that they traveled away from Hashem. By Yisu Mehar Hashem is in fact telling us about an emotional and spiritual state. That Soru Me'achare Hashem, they deviated from following the Ribbono Shel Olam. And Rashi says in the Gemara, Beseich Gimel Yomim Lemasom Hisavu Ha'asaf Suf Taiva. It was within the 3 days of their journeying that they began to want the food, that they began to want the meat. Alabosu kedelim rid ba'kodesh baruch hu, so as to rebel against the Ribbono Shel Olam. There are different kinds of grumblings that one has. Sometimes a person is unhappy about a situation, and that's genuinely that's what they're unhappy about. But sometimes, as Rashi says here, they grumble, and Rashi says the same in Chumash. Kedei limreid ba'kodesh baruch hu. The grumbling about the meat is only an excuse to find to find argument with the Ribbono Shel Olam. There are two kinds of faribles. There's a farible where a person really has a problem. Something he's suffered a misjustice or whatever, and he feels indignant. And there is the faribul where really if it wasn't this he would find something else. He wants to find something to be faribuled about, and he'll grab onto whatever he can find. I said there are two kinds of faribuls. In my opinion, there's really only one kind of faribul. And that's the second kind. The person who will always, if he's faribuled, he will have found something to be faribuled about in any event. Not this, it'll be something else. Because a person who is genuinely has a problem sets about solving it, not getting faribuled. He doesn't grumble and grouch and complain. That's negative. What good does that do? if he really sees a problem, he tackles it. He defines what the problem is, and he gets to grips with it, and he deals with it in a positive and constructive way. The moment you see people start becoming offended and hurt and all that kind of thing as a result of problems, you've got to know that there's nothing you can really do, because solving the problem is not going to solve anything. What they need is to be stroked a little bit, and they need to be pandered to a little bit, and they need to be told how much we love them, and that's really what they want. Or sometimes it's more serious than that. Here it's a kavona limroid ba Hashem. This is a rebellion. This is a desire to overthrow the Ribbono Shel Olam. And if it were, and the meat is just a vehicle that they happen to be using. And so the Rashi says that this is really all one thing, and the argument is that it was within 3 days of leaving the mountain of Hashem, of leaving Har Sinai, that this grumbling took place. And says that it shouldn't be seen to be too close, because that's the problem, that the Torah doesn't want to make it seem that it's really within 3 days they're already grumbling. So we have the break of Vayehi Bimsa Aaron, we have a Pasha in between, and we stop and call a new person up there, it's also Shishi. So by the time we carry on reading, we don't associate it so intimately with an event which took place less than 3 days before, which was Matan Torah. But Tosfos learns it differently. And Tosfos says, Puronus Rishona Kidoma Bemedrash. The first Puronus which the Gemara are talking about, the first misdeed and punishment, was not, as Rashi has explained it, but as the Medrash says, Vayisu Shenosu Mehar Sinai Derech Shloshes Yomim Ketino Kayetze Mibes HaSefer. That they left Mount Sinai like a child leaving school. Shebereach lo, he runs. Child comes out of school, he runs. Vahilech lo, and he gets away as fast as he can. Kach hayu borchim mehar Sinai derech shloshes yomim. Here also, they ran away for 3 days. They made for it. They ran. There was energy. There was rizus. It was too much. They ran away like a child running away from school. And the question is asked: how can that be? We've been told earlier on Api Hashem Yachanu, Api Hashem Yisul. They camped by the word of the mouth, by the mouth of Hashem. They uncamped by the mouth of Hashem. Es Mishmeres Hashem Shemora, Api Hashem Biad Moshe. They never moved without Hashem. When the cloud came, it stopped, and that's where they stopped. When it started moving, it lifted itself up again, and it started moving. Then they moved. So clearly, they didn't leave the Mount Sinai one moment before they were instructed to do. And they went for 3 days, and what does Rashi tell us in the Chumash about those 3 days? It's true that they rushed. It's true that those 3 days were quick. But why were they so quick? Says Rashi, Derech Shloshes Yomim, they went away of 3 days. Mahalach Shloshes Yomim, they went a road of 3 days. Holchu b'yom echol, but it took them only 1 day. So the Medrash is right, they really ran. In 1 day they did what normally takes 3 days. But why, says Rashi, Shoya Kodesh Baruch Hu Chofetz Lach Nisam Leretz Miyod? This was a miracle. Hashem wanted to get them to Eretz Yisrael quickly, so he speeded it all up. It wasn't because they were running out of school. So where does the Medrash find fault with the speed with which they left Har Sinai? What should they have waited there for? What would they have been waiting for? And the answer is given that this must be contrasted with the way they left Yam Suf. The way they left the Red Sea, where the Chumash says, Vayasa, Moshe Esam, that Moshe had to make the people leave. Not Vayisu, not that they left of their own accord. He had to cajole them, he had to motivate them into leaving. They didn't want to leave. So when they left Yam Suf, he had to push them. When they left Har Sinai, they left of their own accord, very nice and quickly. What's the difference? So Chazal tell us that at the Yam Suf, all the beautiful adornments that the Egyptians put on their horses, the gold and the precious stones, was being washed up, and there was an enormous amount of wealth being washed up on the side of the sea, and they were making some money there. It's not wasn't that easy to get them away. And that contrast is what it is suggested is what the Tosfos and the Medrash are talking about. That there they had to be pulled away. At Har Sinai, there was no need to pull them away. They went away themselves. And that contrast disappointed the Ribbono Shel Olam, that they should have left so quickly when they were leaving Har Sinai and taken their time when they were leaving Yam Suf. But that's a difficult answer, because there was reason for them to tarry at Yam Suf. The longer they stayed, the more they could make, the more money they could collect. at Har Sinai there was no reason to stay on. The Torah had been given. Moshe was down from the mountain. What could be gained by further delays? So one can't blame them for when the thing was over. It was time to move on. On the contrary, they're going to Eretz Israel. There's no reason to delay their movement forward. There's nothing to wait for. At Yam Suf, they could have felt that it's important for them to collect whatever they can. This is an opportunity which Hashem has given them. It's clearly been provided for them. And it's in their interests and in the interests of the Jewish people that they should gather as much of that as they could and not just leave it there abandoned. So it was correct for them to delay in their minds. It was correct for them to delay their departure from Yam Suf as long as possible so as to facilitate them collecting as much wealth as they could. But what point would there be in their waiting at Har Sinai? The contrast of the two departures is an unfair contrast because the situations are completely different. And so we need to try and understand this Medrash a little differently. What does the Medrash mean when it says, "Ketino kayetze mibeis ha-sefer, shubereach loy v'hilich loy"? That the Jewish people were criticized for leaving Mount Sinai like a child leaves school. Where he runs, he gets out, he runs as fast as he can and he gets out. What does that mean? When a child leaves school, what is the emotion, what feeling does he leave school with? Because clearly we've got to say that there was no objection to the timing of their departure. That was by instruction from the Ribbono Shel Olam. The only thing there could have been objections about is the emotion with which they left. So what emotion? Tosfos and the Medrash are defining a specific emotion. The emotion of a child fleeing from school. What does that mean? The fact that they went fast, we've already learned, that's not because they were fleeing, that was because Hashem wanted them to get to Eretz Israel quickly. The fact that they left at that time was because that was the right time to leave. So the only criticism can be that they left with an emotion that wasn't altogether in order. What is the emotion with which they left? So the first thing we can say is just a keenness, a desire to get out. And there are cases in the Torah where there is severe criticism leveled at people who did the right thing with a lot of energy because the energy was a little bit misplaced or overemphasized. One beautiful example of that is where Yaakov is criticized for hiding Dinah away from Esav. Dinah, there was supposed to be a shidduch between Dinah and Esav. Now Esav wasn't a very good fellow. And Yaakov, as any good Jewish father would do in his place, did whatever he could to prevent the shidduch between Esav and his daughter Dinah, to the point where he locked her in a box and made sure that Esav couldn't come near to her. And he's criticized for that. And it's for that reason Chazal tell us that the tragedy happened later on with Dinah, because she should have been married by then already, and she should have been married to Esav. What does that mean? That Yaakov was wrong to withhold her from Esav? That Yaakov should have allowed his daughter to marry a Rosho? No, that's not what it means. The Baal HaMusar explained that Yaakov didn't feel enough pain at having to deprive Esav of that shidduch. It's true he has to deprive him of the shidduch. He can't allow his daughter to marry Esav. It's Esav's fault, not his daughter's, and not his fault. If Esav would have turned out the way he was meant to turn out, that would have been the proper shidduch. So he has to deprive Esav of the shidduch. But he has to realize too that that means that Esav's chance of coming to tshuva are diminished still further. Because if anybody could bring Esav to tshuva, it's Dinah who could have done it possibly. So Yaakov should have felt a pang of sorrow at having to deprive his brother of the shidduch with Dinah, his daughter. And not only didn't he feel that, but as Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz used to say, he knocked the nails into the box too hard. Too much energy when he knocked the nails into, there was too much joy in actually knocking those nails in. That's all that was wrong. A little bit too much energy in knocking the nails in. There should have been a little bit less excitement. On the level of a Yaakov Avinu, we can never understand when Chazal speak about things, criticisms leveled at people of that stature, but some kind of a feeling for it we need to develop, and that's how Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz explained it. So we do have situations where the correct action is performed, but there is criticism leveled because the emotion with which that action is performed is not the right emotion, or is an emotion motivated by the wrong driving forces. So the leaving of Har Sinai fast was correct. The action was correct. But the emotion was one of getting away from the past rather than one of being attracted to the future. Deep inside them, the reason for that rush was not because they were going to Eretz Yisrael. In their hearts, the reason for the rush was because the tensions and the stresses of the last 40 days are now over and they can break out. But we need to take it a little bit more deeply than that. And we need to say that when a child leaves school, what he feels is that he can start living now. His day starts when he leaves school. Now he can have some fun, now he can relax, now he can be himself a little bit. Why is it ketinuk haborach mibeis hasefer and not as a person who leaves work, a poel, a worker who leaves his job? He doesn't break out the same way as a child leaves school. If when a person leaves his office, he doesn't feel now life begins. He's a lawyer in his office and he's a lawyer at home. It's no difference. He takes work home with him, whether in his mind or in his briefcase. He doesn't see that life begins after he gets home. He integrates his working life with his home life. He doesn't see that the one is now finished and he's breaking out. Not so the child who comes out of school. When a child comes out of school, he doesn't feel that he's going home to continue what he was doing in school so that he can get back to school the next day or better prepared for his next lessons. He goes, I'm thinking, if I can get away out of doing homework, I will. If I have to do homework, I'll do it in the shortest amount of time that I can. But I can do the things that are really important. I can play my soccer and meet my friends, and then I can do the things that life's really all about. That's the way he leaves school. That's a tinuk habareach mibeis hasefer. Shebareach loy vahilech loy. He runs and goes. He's out, away from it. What does it mean that these great people ran away from Har Sinai? What it means is that they saw the experience of Har Sinai as something super intense, which it was, something all-consuming, which had now come to an end, just as a school day comes to an end. And they could now get on with their normal living. In other words, they perceived a separation between the events at Har Sinai and their day-to-day lives. And they saw themselves getting out of that intense heaviness of the Sinai experience into a lighter day-to-day activity of their normal lives. And that's where we have the difficulties. The Mishnah says that in Pirkei Avos, kol ha-matzik mi-libudoi v'yimer ma-yofe ilon zeh, anybody who stops his learning to comment about the beauty of a tree or a field, a site, it's as if he's committing a capital offense. It's a terrible thing. And the different ways of understanding that Mishnah, that Reb Leib Lopian explains it, that the emphasis is on hamafsik milimudo. Somebody who, in order to comment about the beauty of nature, finds it necessary to stop learning, is not integrating his learning with the rest of his life. If he perceives that as a hefsek, if he perceives that as an interruption, if he's unable to bring that in as part of his learning, that's very serious. Here we have a very important philosophy in the whole handling of a Torah life. There is a chiyuv, there is an obligation when it comes to Torah, you've got to think in Torah day and night, 24 hours a day. You've got to be involved in Torah. What does that mean? How is it possible? You've got to sleep. We've got to eat. We've got to work for a living. How can we be mekayim? How can we fulfill the higisa b'yoyman v'layla? So the simple explanation is, right, you're correct. There are certain things you have to do in order to be able to learn. If you don't eat, you won't be able to learn. So you eat in order to learn. If you don't sleep, you won't be able to learn. So you sleep in order to learn. If you don't work, you won't have the money to buy food. So you work in order to be able to buy the food in order to learn, and so on. But it's much deeper than that. One has to develop a level of integration where one does not perceive the other things that one does as a distraction from one's learning. That even when one is doing things, when one is doing divrei reshus, when one is doing that which is permitted rather than that which is obligatory, one is doing it as an integrated part of a Torah life and not outside the framework of a Torah life. And there are two different philosophies in this area. One philosophy is to construct very rigorous definitions of what a Torah life is. And if you're in shul, if you're davening, if you're learning, you're involved in Torah. If you're out, if you're working, or you're going for a walk, or whatever it is, that's not involved in Torah. And you've got to be involved in Torah as much as possible, and in the rest of the world as little as possible. Simple. That's a very simplistic construction of a Torah lifestyle. And it's a different line that we're describing here. And that is one that one is never permitted to be outside the Torah framework. You can't say that there's such a thing as a Torah framework and outside of the Torah framework, and you've got to be inside the Torah framework as much as possible. You've got to be inside the Torah framework yomam v'layla, day and night. That means that the eating that you do has to be within the Torah framework. The sleeping that you do has to do within the Torah framework. The work that one does has to be within the Torah framework. And even commenting about the beauty of nature has to be within the Torah framework. Even when one's going on a walk in the countryside or a drive through the countryside, that is not to be perceived as hamafsik belimudoy. I have stopped learning in order to take a drive in the countryside. This is part of my learning. This is a continuation of my learning. This is adding a dimension to my understanding of the Ribbono Shel Olam and of his Torah. And if I need to be mafsik, if I perceive that as a hefsik, if I perceive that as an interruption, as a stoppage in my learning process, and I'm moving out of Torah into something else, that's ki'ilu mischayev benafshu. That's very serious. That's like a capital offense, because you have no right to move outside of the framework of Torah. And we're now defining Torah in the broadest sense possible. Torah being thinking, understanding, analyzing, and operating in a way which heightens one's relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam, one's understanding of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And when a child leaves school, he doesn't see any integration between what he's doing in school and the rest of his life. What he's doing in school is going through a procedure which his parents and the government insist that he does, and if he's really a little bit more sophisticated and mature, he understands that it's important for him to get in a trick, and that's why he's doing it. But if there was a way that he could take a sleeping tablet and wake up a number of years later with his matric, that would be fine too. Or if there was a way that he could get a certificate without actually having gone through the process of studying, he would accept that as well. He doesn't really see why it's necessary to go through the procedure of education. And I suppose the way that nowadays children are educated, one can hardly blame children for finding some difficulty in perceiving the relevance of it all. But that's a fault in the educational system rather than in the child. But it is part of the nature of a child, it is part of that immaturity not to be able to see initially what the learning of calculus has to do with his day-to-day life. Why he needs it, how it fits in, what the connectiveness is. He can't see that. And so he just has to go to school, and yes, we have to insist that he goes to school, and one day he'll understand it. But not so with Torah. With Torah, a person should be able to feel at all times, while he's learning Torah, he needs to feel the relevance. And while he's outside, so to say, of learning Torah, he needs to feel the sanctity. That there is no time that he's learning Torah that he feels it's irrelevant, and that there is no time that he's operating in his day-to-day activities that he feels spiritually relevant. Both are problems of irrelevance. What happens is, you get the person who's sometimes a product of the earlier type of system that I described, who while he's learning Torah, is only learning on with a certain part of his application, because he keeps on bothering what is the relevance of it all. Here I am learning about an ox going another ox, or I'm learning about the bringing of a sacrifice, or what really is the relevance of it? Or I'm learning a sophisticated, complicated thing about the laws of Shabbos. Good, I know the laws of Shabbos. I know that I'm not allowed to carry. But this, we've been going on for 3 weeks on three lines of Tosfos about a minute detail of whether this was intended or that was intended. I know the bottom line. I know the Shulchan Aruch. One isn't allowed to carry on Shabbos. Finished. That's it. What is the relevance of all this? And then he goes outside and he finishes learning. And he goes into his day-to-day activities and he starts asking himself, what is the relevance of all this? This isn't Torah, this isn't serving God, this isn't doing anything for me spiritually. And he lives his entire life wondering what the relevance is of what he's doing, because he hasn't performed the process of integration. When the process of integration is concerned, he will find in his learning, no matter what he's learning, a relevance and a process of enrichment for everything else that he's doing. He will see that as he understands that obscure Tosfos better and better, that it's not just a word on the page that he's understanding, but that he is enriching a relationship with God and with God's method of reasoning and his understanding and with what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants of us, that he is communicating with the Ribbono Shel Olam in a way that places him in a far better position to perceive the world as it needs to be perceived, that he comes out feeling strong and powerful and enriched as a result of that. And when he goes about his day-to-day activities, he sees that's part of his religious life too. That's also part of his Torah. That's also part of serving God. And he isn't constantly troubled by questions of relevance. When he's in his day-to-day activities, he sees the spiritual relevance. And when he's in his learning, he sees the practical relevance. He doesn't have a difficulty. Because he's not mafsik b'limudo. He hasn't chopped it up into different sections of life. His life is all one massive whole. Not so the child who's bereach mibeis ha-sefer. He sees school as one thing and playing as another. And while he's playing on the soccer field, he wonders whether he's doing the right thing, because how's that going to help him in his matric? And when he's sitting in school, he wonders whether he's doing the right thing, because what's that really going to help him in life? And so he starts in this mode of chopped up sections which he can't integrate, which he doesn't really find fit into one another to form a picture of a whole. There's another element to this dimension, there's another element to this concept too, which is one that I spoke about some time ago when I spoke about the pleasure of duty. That pleasure and duty must not be separated always. One needs pleasure in one's life and one has to do things. There are duties that one has to get through in life. And a lot of psychologists work on the importance of balancing those two. One needs time for one's duties, one needs time for one's pleasures, which is right. But there's another dimension too, and that is one has to learn to be able to find pleasure in duty. Not to be able to find duty always as in conflict with pleasure, but to be able to find a certain pleasure and richness in duty too. That a child can't do. The child is in school, that's duty, that's obligation. For pleasure, he wants to go and play soccer. And the two conflict with one another. So his bereach mibeis ha-sefer, he runs away from his duties to go to his pleasures. And we have a little bit of this here too. That's the running away from Har Sinai implies a certain feeling of, I can't relax with this. I can't be myself with this. I can't unwind with this. I need to run away somewhere. I need to go somewhere in order to unwind, in order to relax. And that's not what the Torah really wants. The Torah wants a person to be able to fulfill himself in all areas within the Torah structure, within the Torah environment. This concept of interruption is both a time concept and a conceptual concept. That is that one can be doing something and then one has to break what one's doing in order to comment about the beauty of the tree or whatever, and then get back to what one was doing before. That constitutes a hefsek. That's an interruption. And we've often spoken about the negatives of interruption. That you can't compare the value of a 3-hour learning session with 3 1-hour learning sessions. In 3 1-hour learning sessions, one will accomplish maybe 30 or 35 or 40% of what one could accomplish in 1 3-hour session. The parts don't, the whole is not just an addition of the parts. It's something much more than that. And the value of consistency and of non-interruption is emphasized over and over again. There's a beautiful piece of Mesilas Yeshurim based on a Gemara in Sanhedrin. Let's see if I can find it. When he talks about Yiras Shamayim, about the achievement of Yiras Shamayim, which is such an important emotion to develop. And it emerges, says the Mesilas Yeshurim in the 25th Perek, that just as a great quantity of deep contemplation is the method of acquiring Yira Shamayim, the awareness of Hashem, Kein Hesech Hadas Uvitul Ha'ir. Contrarywise, taking one's mind off it and nullifying deep thought, who ha mafsid ha godol shelo, is the greatest damager to the development of Yerushalayim. So it's not that one can develop Yerushalayim and then stop for a while, take a break, and continue from where you left off later on. It doesn't work like that. The taking a break destroys everything you did before. The example that is given is like somebody who wants to boil a kettle of water, but he hasn't got 5 minutes to do it in, and it takes 5 minutes to boil a kettle of water. So he does it bit by bit, comes in the morning, puts it on for a minute, turns it off, comes in a few hours later, puts it on for another minute. So he goes on through the day so that by supper time the kettle will be boiled. He understands that it can't be done as quickly. If you do it in one go, he understands 5 minutes, you'll have the kettle boiling. So he does it 10 times for a minute during the day. Comes supper time, it's as cold as it was when he started. That's how it works. That the hefsek does not leave you static. The hefsek actually allows you to cool down to the point where you're starting up from scratch again every time. And if we would only realize that it's much more energy is expended in having to restart every time than in keeping a consistency going. That applies in all areas. The person is learning consistency. Every night he has a time, he comes to the Seder, he learns, he's in the Shir. Goes much more easily than constantly taking a break. He's there 3 times, he's off once, then he learns through the night, then he's missing, then he's there, then he's up. Each time he's starting from scratch. And each time he has the same difficulties and the same problems, and that's why we have in our own Beis HaMidrash, we have people who've been learning for 1 year, who have achieved incredible results. They're not unusually brilliant, just normal, ordinary people, intelligent, certain, they've been considered, they've had incredible results. And we've got people who've been here for years and years, who haven't achieved the same results. Why? So then one person says, because I'm not suited to Gemara logic, I'm not suited to this. But if you would just take the effort of making a table of who the people are who are not suited to Gemara reasoning, you'll find it's simply the people who boil the kettle sporadically. And they've spent hours and hours, it's not as if they haven't put in time, hours and hours of time. But it's an hour here and a break, 2 hours here and a break, then a week's break, then 5 hours, then another break, then an hour, then another break. And they don't understand why they're not getting anywhere. They're trying to boil the kettle, and they understand it will take a little longer, but they're trying to boil the kettle in spurts, and it doesn't work that way. And so it is with the routines. It's far easier to keep up a routine than it is to take a break from a routine, just in terms of self-discipline. And so it is with Yerushalayim, says the Mrs. Yeshuaim. A break from Yerushalayim doesn't mean that you can carry on from where you left off. A break from Yerushalayim, if you take your mind off Yerushalayim, when you come back to it, you're starting from scratch again. Yiyeh machmas tirdus or berotzer, it makes no difference whether the reason for that hesach hadas, for that lapse in attentiveness, whether it's because of the circumstances, pressures, or deliberate. Kol hesach das bitul hu liyirah atmidus. Any lack of attentiveness, any lapse in attentiveness, is a destruction of continuous yirah. That's why Hashem instructs the king. That he has to have the Sefer Torah with him. He must read it all the days of his life. Study the Torah. He mustn't move without the Torah so that there will never be a time when he can't learn. So that he can learn to fear the Ribbono Shel Olam. So you see, that fear of God can only be acquired through continuous and uninterrupted study. And this applies to everybody, not just to the king. The king is given as the example. He who's got the most on his head, who has the most disruption and the most of a life which is not his own, where time is not his own, even he has to carry a Sefer Torah around and learn continuously. Certainly we ordinary people have to. So we see that there is no concession for learning in spurts. There's Laman Yilmud Yusuf, the Korobay Kolyume Chayav. There's got to be continuous involvement in the Torah process. How does one do that? One has to work, one has to do all these things. Well, we'll see in a moment how that's done. But one has to see that as part of an integrated whole. One cannot afford to take a break from Torah and from Yerushalayim. That's the example, the beautiful of Chaim Shmuel Levitz. We tell the story of Rabbi Akiva, you remember, goes away for 12 years. Learns Torah, becomes very great, comes home, and he's about to go inside, and he hears his wife, who's waited for him for 12 years, talking to her friend, and the friend is criticizing her and criticizing him. How can he leave you like this for 12 years? And you're a living widow. And she says, you know, if he came back and he wanted to go for another 12 years, I would give him my blessing. And Rabbi Akiva turns around and goes back for another 12 years. And Rabbi Chaim Shmulevitz asks, come inside and have a cup of tea and say hello to her. Give her that pleasure. You're right there already. What kind of derech eretz? To turn around and go back for another 12 years without coming in to say Shalom Aleichem. And he says, because Rabbi Akiva realized that 12 and 12 doesn't make 24. The moments that would take, just the moments of lapse in attentiveness that would be required in order to say hello to his wife, was a lapse that he couldn't afford if he really wanted to maximize on that second 12 years. 12 and 12 doesn't make 24. And the same example we've got with the Yaakov, when he comes and he lies down at Beit El, and the Chazal tell us that was the first time he'd slept in all the years that he was studying in the yeshiva of Shem Ve'Even. And Reb Chaim Shmulevitz says, and how did he sleep there? He slept on the ground with a stone. That means a stone is his pillow. That means not only had he never slept in a bed before, but he'd never even slept on the ground with a stone as a pillow before. Why not? What's so terrible? Sleep. That's like he wasn't prepared to take his mind off. So these are on the extreme levels of greatness which are far beyond our comprehension. But the concept is there that one needs to understand, that we cannot afford hefsek. And what I'm talking about this evening is not so much whether one does other things apart from learning. In the kind of lives that we live, we have to do other things apart from learning. The question is perception. Do I allow myself to perceive that as a break from Torah, or is this part of Torah, or is this an integrated part of Torah? If I perceive it as a break from Torah, then when I get back to my Torah, I'm starting from scratch. If I can develop the resources and the attentiveness to be able to see that as an integrated part of my Torah life and not as a break, then it's possible that I can get back to my Torah without having suffered that same complete drop. And just as one has times of work, and one has times of sleeping, and one has times of eating, so one has times of social interaction, which is part of normal living, and one even has time of leisure and relaxation. The example of admiring the beauty of the tree, but one has to be careful that in one's choice of leisure, one doesn't choose activities which by their nature cannot possibly be considered as part of our Torah experience. It's all very well if one goes, depending where one's holding, if one goes to see a musical concert, or one goes to see a piece of classical theatre, or of something which is artistically very beautiful and of a high standard, a high intellectual standard that stimulates one's thinking, that enriches one's mind. No, so depending on where one's holding and what one would otherwise be doing with one's time, if one analyzes it properly and relates to it properly, one could see that also as part of one's growth experience, as part of one's development, and as part of one's movement in a total line. But if one goes to forms of leisure and entertainment which by their very nature are anti-everything that the Torah is, and they do nothing but distract one from the thoughts and the ideas and the depth which Torah demands of one, then one cannot possibly regard that as being part of a Torah experience. What does one do with the simple necessities of life? One needs to work. How does one integrate that as part of a Torah life? There's a piece of Derech Hashem which I did with the ladies on Friday, which is so classical and important, but I wouldn't like any of the men or the ladies who are not at that shiur to miss it. Where the Derech Hashem discusses, this is in the fifth perek of the fourth chelek, and the Derech Hashem discusses the purpose of tefillah. The age-old question, why do we have to pray? Hashem knows what we want. We don't have to tell him what we want. He knows. Why is it necessary to pray? So he gives the first reason, the general reason that is given, and that is that Hashem designed the world in such a way that there's an awful lot ready for us, but like any good educator, he's not going to give it to us unless we make the effort. Not to give, what is spoiling a child? Spoiling a child is when you give a child something which he has made no effort to achieve. That's when you spoil a child, no matter what it is that one gives, whether it's something physical or whether it's something emotional. If the child makes no effort at all and one carries on giving and giving and giving, then one asks for the kind of trouble and problems that one has later on. That's what spoiling a child is. Spoiling a child is not showing the child love or too much love. You can't show a child too much love. But you can ruin a child by giving the child anything, love or material things, which the child is making no effort whatever to achieve. And so the Ribbono Shel Olam teaches us that too. And no matter what he's got for us, if we don't at least daven for it, if we don't at least ask for it, just that, he doesn't give it. But then the Derech Hashem says, "V'omnam oimek yose yesh b'inyan," the most beautiful piece of Derech Hashem. But there is something deeper in the concept too. V'hu ki hineh ha'adon baruch hu noson l'adam de'ali yis manig atzmoi ba'olamoi b'seichel uvisuvino v'hem is hamosa olav liyus mefatiach ha'atzorich of kulo. Hashem designed the world in such a way and designed man in such a way that he gave us the knowledge, the intellect and the seichel, common sense, to be able to conduct our own affairs in the world using wisdom and understanding, and burdened us with the obligation of attending to our own requirements, unlike any other species in the world. The rest of the species of the creation are provided for by intuition and by nature. They don't have to sit and plan and strategize and draw up balance sheets and make 5-year plans and all sorts of things. They don't have to do that. They go about from day to day and everything gets sorted out. Not so the human being. He has to strategize, he has to plan, he has to conduct his life using his seichel. So Hashem created the world in such a way that he wants us to use our minds not only for the study of Torah, he wants us to use our minds in the conduct of our day-to-day affairs as well. He wants us to use our brilliance in the achievement of our well-being. And this is based on two principles. One is because man is so precious. That man has been given the knowledge to be able to do that. To be able to, that's a tremendous compliment, to be able to say to a person, I don't have to provide for you, you have the wisdom to do it yourself. That's what the Ribbono Shel Olam says. For the monkeys, I've got to provide for the lions and for the cheetahs and for the buck and the cows and the oxen. I've got to provide for. But you're a human being. I don't have to provide for you in the same type of way. You've got seichel. You can create your own environment. You can do it yourself. That's a tremendous stature in which, an esteem in which the Ribbono Shel Olam holds us. And we need to be honored. We need to feel singled out and honored, not abandoned, by the fact that we have the creative ability to look after our own affairs. Vasheni, but there's another principle. Liyos lo esek ba'ilom, Hashem wanted us to be involved in the world, velikoshu b'inyonov, and attached to its dealings. Hashem did not want us to be separate from the world. And if he had given us a Torah, and provided for us like he provides for the animals, we would disassociate ourselves from the world. We would lock ourselves in little rooms, and we would learn all day and all night, and we wouldn't be involved in the world. Mankind would not be involved in the world, and Hashem didn't want that. He wanted li yishle esek ba'ilam. Man must have dealings with the world, velikosher binyonav, and to be attached to the world. And that's what makes him a human being and keeps him a human being. Shehu derech chol v'lo kodesh. But one has to realize that is chol. It's not kodesh. Chol, secularity. It's not sanctity. When we're involved in dealing with the world, that's not the same as learning a piece of Gemara. We're involved in something secular, but Hashem wanted it that way. He wanted us to involve ourselves in the secular part of the world too. V'hu mashim itztorech lo bizmano zeh. That is something which he needs at this time. So yes, we don't want to say by what I said earlier that we're integrating our day-to-day life with our Torah. Yes, we integrate it. And we see it part of as part of an integrated whole, but we still have to understand, as we just said in Havdalah, Hamavdil ben Kodesh l'chol, there is still a difference between Kodesh and Chol. When I'm in shul davening, that's not the same as being in my office working. When I'm learning a black Gemara, that's not the same as when I'm seeing a customer. One is Kodesh and one is Chol. One is sanctity and one is secularity. However, it's a necessary secularity. Hashem wanted the world in such a way where I involve myself in that secular activity. And that's not a compliment in a sense, that's a deterioration. That I've got to detach myself from Kodesh and occupy myself with Chol. That I have to detach myself from sanctity and occupy myself with secularity. That's a deterioration, that's a come down. But it's a necessary come down. So Sometimes we have to travel downhill too. Can't always be going up. We have to go down and up. And Hashem wanted the world in such a way that we take these downhill trips occasionally too. V'goremes lo aliyo acharecha. And it causes him a subsequent increase. One develops velocity when one's going downhill. And so one has to go downhill sometimes. But the downhill has to be in constructive ways. The way we go downhill is through our secular activity, through working, through the things that we need to do as much as we need to do it. On the other hand, although this is a necessary deterioration, it's a necessary downhill run, and it will generate more uphill energy afterwards. On the other hand, we have to be careful not to do too much. If you run too far downhill, you're not going to be able to get uphill afterwards. So we have to balance it and measure it correctly, that yes, we're going downhill and it's necessary and it's going to bring us to greater heights later, but it all has to be controlled and watched. Because one needs to know that the more one becomes intertwined with the affairs of this world, so we are becoming further from the energy of Hashem and we become more involved in darkness. So while we have to be involved in secular activity and Hashem wants it that way, and we have to be involved in the world, it is a yirida, it is a downward run. And although it is a downward run that's going to bring us to heights ultimately, but we need to know that the more we become involved in the day-to-day affairs of the world, every moment that we're being involved, we are drawing ourselves further away from Hashem. So how do we cope with it? Hashem prepared a method of coping. That is that before man goes about his secular activities, he stands before Hashem and gets close to him. And asks Hashem for success in all the activities he's about to undertake. And he throws his trust on Hashem. And this becomes a general and fundamental beginning to all of his physical efforts. To the point that when he then involves himself in his material efforts, in his physical activities, which is normal human activity, he will not find himself becoming intertwined and sinking into physicality and materialism. Since he preceded it all with an attachment of his physical activities to Hashem. And the example I gave on Friday morning is making kiddush. Drinking a glass of wine, that's a secular activity. But by making kiddush first, and the actual physical act of drinking the wine is merely the culmination of the whole process of kiddush, that ensures that the act of drinking the wine is as spiritual as wine drinking can possibly be. The fact is, drinking wine is still a physical act. And it's got to be a physical act, and Hashem wants it to be physical, and the wine has to look good, and the wine has to taste good. And if it was purely spiritual, it wouldn't make any difference how the wine tasted, and it wouldn't make any difference how the wine looked. All that would be important is that it's halakhically classified as wine. But that's not the din. In addition to it being halakhically classified as kosher wine, it must also be good wine. That's the halakhas of kiddush. So we see it's got to be a physical act enjoyed physically, but preceded with kiddush. And if the emphasis, and if you look at the proportion of time and energy, that's about right. A long kiddush with a moment of drinking the wine. That would be the correct proportion if we went about our lives properly. We should spend 5 or 6 hours davening and go out to work for an hour. And you know what? We would achieve more in that hour than by davening for half an hour and going to work for 10. The way it would work, we just don't believe in Hashem really. If we really believed in Hashem, that's what we would do. But we don't really believe in Hashem. We would like to believe in Hashem. We pretend we believe in Hashem. We try to convince ourselves that we believe in Hashem. But if we really believed in Hashem, that's what we would do. We would be at the davening an hour before davening starts, so that the davening should be good, because we would know that the quality and success of our day depends on one thing only, and that's the quality of our davening. That's the only thing that is really important. Yeah, then we've got to go through the motions of doing the thing properly, just as you have to drink the wine. You can't put the wine down on the table and, like Eliyahu HaNavi on Pesach night, expect the drinking process to take place magically. it isn't going to take place magically. You have to take the wine in your hand and you have to put it to your mouth and you have to drink and you have to swallow. That has to be done. And so when you go out to work, you've got to go and you've got to go to your office and do your work and see your customers. Otherwise, nothing's going to happen. But the success is going to depend on the davening and on the quality of the davening, not on the quality of the work. Not only the quality of the work is a condition. Unless there's quality of work, there will not be success. But if there is quality of work, there also won't be success. If there isn't siyata dishmaya. And the more siyata dishmaya there is, the more success there will be. That's what we should believe. But if we did believe that, then we would be at the davening early, we would daven with all our hearts and with all our might, and we would stay afterwards a little bit longer and do some learning after the davening, and then we would go off and we would do our work in the shortest time possible, get back to shul for mincha on time, for ma'ariv, and for a learning seder, and our lives would be different lives. But we don't believe in Hashem, what can we do? We're not believers, we're atheists. We go about we talk about believing in Hashem, and we say all the right formulas, and we do go through the motion of davening, but we don't believe that it really works. Because if we believe that it really works, the way we would daven would be very different. Sometimes we do believe it really works when everything else has failed. When the bank manager phones and says, I'm calling in your overdraft tomorrow, then we believe davening works, because nothing else works, so why not believe that davening might work? Then we daven properly. That's the only time. And then the bank manager phones the next day and says, you know what, I'll give you another week. And then we say Baruch Hashem, because that's the right thing to say, but we don't really believe it. Because if we really believed Baruch Hashem, we would put the phone down from the bank manager and we would go back to shul and we would say Tehillim and we would give tzedakah and we would spend the whole day learning. That's what we would do. But we don't. We say, Baruch Hashem, let's go out for a drink. That's what we say. Let's celebrate. So what is that? Believing in the Ribbono Shel Olam? It's not believing in the Ribbono Shel Olam. So what I'm saying is we mustn't fool ourselves into thinking that we're religious people. We act like religious people and we go through the motions, but we're not really religious people. We're trying to get there. It's a long way to go still. But the test of whether we're religious people or not, these are the tests. That's where we can really see what happens. And so, if we attach our success in the davening process to Hashem, and then the activity of work is merely going through the routine. In other words, it has to be exactly the opposite for the way we do it. We put our heart and effort into our work and we go through davening like a routine. What has to be done is exactly the opposite. We have to put our heart and effort into the davening and go through the work like a routine. It's something which has to be done. So you do it as competently and as efficiently and as quickly as you can and you get back to your Torah. That's the way it should be. And if it's done that way, says the Derech Hashem, then one finds that one is not becoming involved in the physical side of life to the point where it's distracting one and pulling away from one away from the sanctity of life and from the godliness of life. Then one can integrate. Then one can find, just as when one's drinking the wine after Kiddush, you don't think to yourself, what an animal I am. Isn't this terrible? Drinking wine. What a terrible thing to be doing. I should be thinking holy thoughts. I should be thinking of Torah. I should still be saying Kiddush. I should be benching already maybe. Who knows? Don't think that. It's quite okay, quite legitimate to drink the wine and you comment about how delicious the wine is and you feel fine. It's integrated. It's part of Kiddush. And then you make motzi and you say a broche and you eat the bread and you comment how delicious the challah is and you don't say, what a terrible, how could I have said such a thing? Am I an animal? Physical things? The taste of the bread, should that be important to me? You don't say that. Huh? Lovely challah, delicious challah, you don't feel bad, it's integrated. That's part of hamotzi. So it is with work. Davening is the broche and working is the action. And the two are integrated just as the broche is integrated with the eating. Then one finds that the physical action is not a distraction. The physical action is then a continuity of the spiritual action. And that's what the Ribbono Shel Olam was worried about when Bnei Yisrael left Har Sinai. Vayisu mehar Hashem, they traveled away. Not that they traveled away geographically. Of course they traveled away geographically. They were going to Eretz Yisrael. And the moment that the Torah was no longer being given, Har Sinai ceased to have any kedusha. We don't attach sanctity to Har Sinai. Even today, if we knew what mountain it is, it doesn't have any specific sanctity. It's finished, its job's over. There was no reason to stay behind. But to see the movement as a travel, to see and feel themselves as moving away from it, rather than taking it with them, is what Hashem was concerned about. And what in fact happens in the next parsha? The very Puranius which the Ribbono Shel Olam wants to separate from the first one. These people come, the Asafs have come, Eilu Erev Rav, this is Rashi, this is the Erev Rav. And they say, Mi achil en abosel, we want meat. And then they go and they say, Zochalnu es hadogo asher noicha b'mitzrayim chinam. Those good old days in Egypt. Ha! When we used to get fish for nothing. Aren't people amazing? But people are still the same. Es hakishuyim ves havatichim. Ha! The wonderful pumpkins and the cucumbers and the marrows we used to get. Wonderful. The onions. Well, it was a delicious, wonderful time we had in Egypt. Asks Rashi. What are they talking about? Fish for nothing. Even the building material wasn't given to them, if you remember. Paro stopped supplying them with their building material. They had to work for that themselves. If they didn't give them the straw to make the bricks, do you think the Paro gave them fish? So what is it they're talking about? Chinom min hamitzvos. They got their food without having to do mitzvahs. There was not a moral cause and effect. There was not a spiritual cause and effect. There was purely a material cause and effect. When they wanted to do mitzvahs, they went to shul, they had their religious life, they did their mitzvahs. When they were at work, they were doing work. And if they worked well, they got paid. And that was fine, they enjoyed that life. Now the two have become mixed up together. If they don't learn well and pray well, they don't get food. That they don't want. Learning well and praying well, that's one part of their life. Good, we have to do that, fine. But we have to work well as well. We have to do our business. And that's also fine. But the two should have nothing to do with each other. We don't want a situation where I've got to think that the reason my bank manager phoned me up to tell me he's calling in the overdraft might not be because I'm running my business badly. It might be because I didn't daven well this morning. That kind of thing I don't want on my shoulders. I want separation. So we see a continuity. We see the consequence of Vayisu Mehar Sinai. We see the consequence of them traveling away from our Sinai. There's that same tendency of wanting to keep the sanctity of their Torah life tightly sealed from the day-to-day secularity of their ordinary life. And that's what they're criticized for. There cannot be a moving away from our Sinai into an ordinary life. There is no such thing as an ordinary life for a Jew. A Jew is always at the feet of our Sinai. And whether he's learning Torah, or he's working, or he's traveling, he's always in the presence of Hashem. And he needs to see that all as part of an integrated life. A life which has its spiritual and it has its physical. It has its kodesh and it has its chul. It has its sanctity and it has its secularity. But they're not opposites. They're not in conflict with one another. They do create tensions. And it's important to understand at all times that there is nothing negative about tensions. Nothing in the world happens if there are no tensions. There's a difference between conflict and tensions. Conflict is negative. Tensions are positive. And secular and kodesh, chol and kodesh are two poles which create tensions. And man is oscillating in the tension, in the midst of the tension created by these two poles. But that's his life, that's how it's meant to be. And he needs to resolve those tensions and he needs to create a harmony from those tensions. And the first thing in the creation of a harmony is separation, in the sense of an understanding that this is kodesh and this is chol. But then must come not mere separation. Having separated, then they need to be reunited in an integrated sense as defined by the Derech Hashem, where the chol is preceded by the sanctity. Where the beginning of everything, the purpose of everything, the dynamics and the direction of everything is kodesh. And the chol is merely the physical skeleton, the bones and flesh that form the activity of day-to-day life. That has to be there, but not as something separate. Our body and our soul, that's exactly what it is. We don't have a body in one place and a soul in another place and separate them. The moment body and soul become separated, we've got a funeral on our hands. And we don't like that. We don't separate body and soul. We understand they have to be integrated. They have to function in tandem. So it is with all our lives. When a person starts separating his spiritual and his secular and not understanding their connectedness and how they operate in harmony as the Derech Hashem defined, there is a deathliness at his hands. There's a spiritual deathliness and there's a physical deathliness. And when we talk about the life of Torah, the chayus of Torah, the etz chayim of Torah, we're talking about a Torah that lives in this world, not just that lives in a spiritual world. And life in this world means an understanding of the sanctity of life, which is the taking of that which is physical, the uplifting of it and the dedicating it to that which is holy, to that which is kodesh.